Hi, and welcome to the Cloud Computing Show, episode number 35. We are here with Jason Huggins, the founder of Sauce Labs. Hi, Jason.
Hi.
And I'm Gary Ornstein, the host of the Cloud Computing Show. We had this opportunity to get Jason while he was in the Bay Area before he heads back to Chicago. And you will have just heard a few days ago the roundtable episode where we did a lot of coverage of the industry news. So for this particular episode, we're going to skip over the industry news section and jump right into the Q&A for Jason and Sauce Labs. And we'll start out, Jason, just give us a little introduction about yourself and your background, maybe prior to founding Sauce Labs.
Sure. I won't bore you with too many details, but I will give you some details. Sort of out of college, I've got to see a good wide swath of every kind of role you can possibly have in software and computers. So right out of college, I was a consultant for PeopleSoft, which has now been subsumed into Oracle. Was that admin thing. But left PeopleSoft, was there for 2.5 years, went to ThoughtWorks consultancy in Chicago. And I went in as the PeopleSoft admin, Oracle DBA, a down in the dungeons IT admin, keeping all this stuff on. It was quite embarrassing, right? Because on the package apps maintainer at a custom software shop. So that was definitely the people you don't talk about at Thanksgiving, right? And then around 2004, the bread and butter, the main thing for a consulting shop is your time expense system. Like, you only, what you sell, your product, is billable hours.
Right. It's like being a lawyer.
Exactly. So the time and expense system is actually the...
Did you do 6-minute increments like the lawyers do?
Well, that's not good. But my wife's a lawyer. Anyway, so the time expense system was something that was really, about Mutiny was upon us with all the consultants. It was designed when the company was just one office. And anyway, So I got to be the tech lead, jack of all trades, DBA, kind of manager of sorts of this new project to create this new time expense system. And so getting to the point here, from that project, Selenium came out of it because we said, hey, let's do this as a web app. It's 2004, let's where we go, no, 2004. Bravely into the future, let's use this stuff that everyone else has been using for 8 years, and let's do this as a web thing. And with the crazy kids that we had at ThoughtWorks, you couldn't just, as an IT drone, just say, everyone's going to use IE6 Microsoft, and that's the way it's going to be. You have very independent-minded people. Anyway, so we had this web app that we wanted to create. It needed to work in multiple browsers, and right at that time, it was about 6 months before the word Ajax was coined, but before that, it basically meant, Ajax means it's okay to use JavaScript, but 6 months prior, you were laughed out of the building to use JavaScript, but we decided to do it anyway because it let us do some features fast. You could reduce a lot of traffic to the server by doing this JavaScript stuff. So we need cross-browser, we need to use JavaScript, we want to make this fast web app, and then from there, we realized, wow, this stuff is really hard to test and keep working in IE and all these different browsers. So from that, we realized we had to test it, realized there were no other testing tools, created Selenium, and then from there, the story goes faster.
Right. So you're building this web app in the early days of web apps, like, this is hard to test across all these different things. I'm not going to try to force people to use the same browser. And that led to you creating Selenium. And so for people who aren't aware or know what Selenium is, give us an overview of that.
Right. So it's basically a software library that acts as a user would walking through your application. So it can start a browser, go to a page, type on button, type into fields, click on buttons. Those get, assert things.
So you can write code to act as if a user were visiting a web page.
Exactly.
Filling out a form.
Exactly. So what happens if you're a Amazon or an eBay, you've got a shopping cart, people click on products, it gets filled up, you have to check out, and your credit card, you want to make sure that that workflow through the application works. And it works for all the different ways you use that web app, and it works on all the different browsers and all the different platforms. So this combinatorial nightmare of so many different paths to test and verify.
Right. Now, today, I mean, when people talk about browser testing, we think of these massive websites and, the Amazons and the eBays a little. But in 2004 or 5, when you were doing this, like those that wasn't really the main thing. Like, the problem you were solving at the time was much more contained in size and scale.
It was the specific pain point. It was one little button. When I give a talk about Selenium, I actually show a screenshot of what caused us to create Selenium. It was one little thing. It was an expense report, a little ad row. what happened is JavaScript cloned the last row, blanked out the values, and then added a new blank row to the expense report. And that was Ajax. Not even Ajax, it was just JavaScript.
Just a little bug.
Yeah, the thing was, it would work 1 week in IE, and then we'd notice, oh, hey, it was broken in Mozilla. So I'd file a bug saying, hey, guys, fix this in Mozilla. Of course they do. They check it in. Surprise, surprise, what do you know? It's working in Mozilla, and it's now broken in IE. So we had this, I call it the sine wave of quality for
right.
a while, and I basically kind of mandated to the project, okay, that's it. We're going to figure out a way that we can write one test, and that's going to be able to kind of just lock down this one feature so it works on these different browsers.
Right.
And that, it was a very simple little button, but everything kind of sprang from that.
Right, and the testing at that scale, compared to the testing that people do today with Selenium, was much more, localized and you could handle quite easily. So, like, today, people are testing massive
right.
stuff with Selenium. So how has Selenium adapted in the course of going from that initial kind of testing that you were doing
right.
for a single app with, six browsers or whatever it was to today? Or,
right. So one of the things that left Thoughtworks went to Google, and that's where I got to see the other end of the spectrum. I got to see the tens of thousands of tests. Gmail, I think, was probably the most famous one. I think they had the most tests. And, I mean, at some point, it was all Google apps were using Selenium. So I was on the Selenium farm team, and we got to see all of this stuff
right.
running at scale. And so, of course, not too many entities have did that much of loads, but finding lots of weird bugs to fix. So I've kind of seen it as like one developer, one browser, one test, one push to production that you're just trying to get done
right.
versus this huge scale where you've got dozens of people involved. So it's,
yeah. I want to talk a little bit more about that when we get further along in terms of how things are actually implemented and maybe how that initial implementation you did is different from when people are dealing with the Selenium farms and so
mm-hmm.
forth. But before we get there, what led to the impetus for starting Sauce Labs, which is really focused on Selenium and providing support and services around Selenium? So maybe give us a background on what Sauce
right.
Labs is specifically, and I'm curious what led you to start the company.
Right. So I started Selenium when I had one thing I needed to test. And the company is pretty much, its genesis is when you've got 100 tests or 1,000 tests, there's this problem when people just attribute it to Selenium or functional testing tools in general that testing tools stink because these tests run slowly. We actually found on projects at Google and also at ThoughtWorks that there's this notion of you can throw more hardware at the problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of how Google does their stuff. They just get lots of machines and distribute the stuff across those machines.
Yeah.
Surprise, surprise, everything goes faster when you distribute the load. And you kind of, it's one step forward, one step backward. You now could, my example is if most people, when they're setting up their infrastructure, they have the one Selenium machine, it runs the one test, and then when they have tests 2, 3, 4, 5 get checked in, they still get run on that same machine. Well, before you know it, weeks, months later, you've got one machine running tests and it takes an hour and a half, about 100 tests or something like that. And what you flip it on its head is you get 100 machines, you run them all in parallel, and now, boom, you're back to everything running theoretically in a minute.
Right. So that infrastructure of how do you go from one machine, one test to...
Yeah, so enter cloud computing because, and again, we had kind of access to these kinds of resources, being a Googler, all these fun things, but Amazon comes along and now you too can be like a Googler. You can go get access to lots of machines.
Right.
And... But the thing is, even if you can do it, it doesn't mean it's easy to do. To actually, you now have to, before cloud computing, you have to go make a requisition for 100 machines. And
right.
guaranteed, if you're in testing, that money for 100 machines is going to go to your production systems, not your test infrastructure. No matter how important it is, it's kind of a second tier importance. So in this sense, EC2 is a big enabler for what Sauce is doing. And so what we do is we will configure all of the machines in the cloud. We're a little bit different because we're not servers in the cloud. We're actually running desktop images in the cloud. We're running Ubuntu desktop, Windows desktop.
Because you want to emulate
sort
of end user.
Right, so it's actually weird. Usually you measure a server in requests per second, but we measure it in seconds per request, right? You're driving a browser for 30 seconds. You own that machine
mm-hmm.
for that period of time. You're the only person on that box. And yeah, so we just kind of, there is this management complexity. Now that you get your tests running faster, you still have, every time a new browser version comes out, or an operating system a patch comes out, that is, you have to make the decision, like, okay, we have 50 machines that are running IE8. IE9 comes out. Now, do you go make a request for more machines, or do you split your lab between IE8 and IE9? I think of this in terms of carnival, like plate spinning. You're constantly keeping all these plates spinning, and it's keeping you away from actually just writing code and shipping stuff like this. So we come in really at this, get your tests running faster. It was the first thing that we solve, but we accidentally discovered that the bigger problem, more valuable problem, is that before you even get to the nice problem of having 100 tests, people just don't even want to maintain this infrastructure at all.
Right.
So they actually get there in the situation where they're running a test on one machine because they just don't even want to fathom the idea of what it would take to get 100 machines
right. All
up and running and working.
Now, how much of this, and I'm not a testing expert, so forgive the question, but how much of this is sort of functional testing compared to load testing? Because you hear about people queuing up thousands of virtual machines in the cloud to send a barrage of stuff from a load perspective. I get the sense that this is more on the function.
Right. So there's kind of a trilogy. If you want to take a playbook, and start a testing company for dummies, then you would go into load testing, functional testing, production monitoring, but a little bit more fancy than that. And we're focused on functional testing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an obvious playbook of like, well, what else are you doing? Like load testing,
right? So do you the load testing now?
Testing.
Do you refer people to partners or have, like, if I need to do the spectrum,
right. What
does the spectrum look like if I've got Sauce Labs and Selenium for the functional side?
Right.
What do I do with those other pieces today?
Right. So within load, we're friends with Patrick Lightbody. He's also a committer on the Selenium project, and he did a load testing startup. BrowserMod was his.
Okay.
So we don't have any official partnerships, but I'm very happy to say, hey, I want to use that. Although he and I, we have a kind of a philosophical difference of opinion. Like, I think there's a question of what's the most effective way to do a load test. And he actually does it with browsers. I would just say, Apache Bench is a great little tool that can, if you want to see the server fall down, just fire up a couple of machines, have Apache Bench just generate this load.
So just hit a particular page and see if that page can load?
Right. The counter argument is if you've got a very fancy Ajax-y page, like Google Maps or something, just hitting one page is actually not good representation of load. So you do need to bring in some browsers and potentially script it with Selenium. That would be real traffic. So I think, I can completely geek out on my philosophical stance on what's the proper way to do a load test.
Sure.
I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
But for now, we're focused on functional testing.
Right. And then on the production monitoring side, what do people do there? Like, okay, I've done my functional testing, my thing's up and running, but I want to have somebody make sure I'm up.
So at the moment, we actually use our own service to monitor our stuff because, you can... So that's kind of a... We're eating our own dog food on that point.
Okay.
Open source stuff, you can then... at the very low level, the poor man's way to do it. You get a cron job, you get a cloud machine from EC2 or Rackspace Cloud or something like that. You just set something up and it just goes.
Right.
It
seems like even renting my own server to do that would be a lot of overhead if I just need somebody to ping me on occasion.
Right. So there are like dozens, perhaps hundreds of like pinging services. I think the weakness for them is that they can only get like a status update. They can't tell you that, yes, your shopping cart shows up, but can you actually complete an order?
Gotcha.
That is perhaps the Achilles heel, and almost, I would just say easily 99% of all of the production monitoring services that are out there.
But then a production monitoring service could use Selenium to go one step further?
Right, right. So, one potential thing you could do is, like, Hyperic is another kind of well-known player in the space. And they can kick off tests and give you pretty dashboards for what you can do. So one thing you could do is have that kick off a Selenium test and just have it scheduled and get the results that way.
Yeah.
But right now, we just kind of run it on the cron job every couple of minutes, and then we get the results back.
So give us a few marquee case studies or customer examples so people can really dig their teeth into this and understand, when are the best times to use Selenium and what kind of things are going to take place or what's some of the customer benefits, customer stories of using it and...
Right, so the real cool kids on the block are talking. There's a couple of phrases and buzzwords, lean startup, and from the Eric Ries is the high priest of that. If you actually dive into the practices that are in there, the ceremonial things, if you will, of the religion, there's other key phrases like continuous employment, which is interesting because a couple of thought works where Martin Fowler kind of coined the phrase continuous integration. We've got a whole tangent here, but it really meant it means to build, test, deploy all the time. That's what continuous integration used to mean. However, it somehow just became build and test. It never actually got the deploy part. Continuous deployment is kind of redefining what CI was, and part of Lean Startup is everyone is aspiring. The cool kids are aspiring to do continuous deployments, and IMVU is an example there, where they, to be able to deploy many, many times during the day, you have to have lots of testing, very comprehensive testing.
And so, all automate because there's no time.
And all automate, right. If you're deploying 50 times a day, there's no way you can take time and say, oh, hey, Bob, can you please test? So that's where kind of Selenium comes in, Sauce Labs can come in, where you can get all that stuff fast. I think we're one of our marquee customers, if you will, is Dig. And we've drunk the Kool-Aid on the startup, so is Dig. They're trying to push towards continuous deployment, and they're using Sauce and Selenium to kind of really drive that. So they can just really focus on deploying often.
Mm-hmm.
So testing is a huge part of that breakfast of continuous deployment.
Right. Let's dig into some of the details here in terms of how this actually works. So I just want to understand the components and the pieces and what's what. So I'm building an application. I've got my Apache web server tier,
mm-hmm.
and it's a basic application. Maybe I'm doing some kind of photo sharing site.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm going to take over the world and be Flickr and Facebook at photo sharing, and I want to make sure that I've got a continuous deployment. What are the pieces that I have to put in place?
So
I've got to write a test script
in
Selenium, and then where does that go, and how do I stage? Like, just give me a basic blueprint.
So there are probably, or maybe at a minimum, three legs of stool here. You've got your application, in testing land, they would call that the application under test, the AUT, but it's basically your application. And let's take an example. Let's say you're a Heroku user. So you've got your code, and then through their commands, you're going to push out your update. So Heroku will now start up a new version of your application running in the cloud. And so that's your application. So leg one, right? And then leg number two would be your test. And in development and testing land, you would most likely use a test library, probably a port of JUnit. They call them XUnit. It's the XUnit family of test premises. And it really is a library that can give you lots of different ways to assert things are so or not so. So use that test library combined with the Selenium library to create a test. And so that's kind of like number two, just this test, whatever library. In Ruby land, you would use, there's a million options. Shoulda, RSpec, Cucumber. It seems like it's a rite of passage for a Ruby programmer to write a new testing library. The third leg here is your test. Will talk to Selenium or talk to Sauce Labs, where it's going to. It kind of comes from Selenium has one kind of tool in its toolbox called Selenium Remote Control. So we really are acting kind of like a remote control car. Like, over the wire, you were saying to us, "Hey, start a browser." Okay,
get so I give you the test, but now it's your job.
Oh wait.
The hosted service is actually going to run the test.
So right now, imagine your Heroku app is in the cloud. We're in the cloud. The browser's in the cloud. Right now, at this moment, your test though is running on your laptop. It could be running on C2 machine. Actually, we don't care so much where it is.
Okay.
Ideally, everything's easier if everything is in the cloud.
Okay.
You don't have to deal with firewall issues and things
right.
like that. But
where do I push the test to say now run from afar?
So usually when you look at code, there's the actual application and then the test, the everything else,
right.
You know, the supporting stuff. So you're in this particular case, a Heroku deployment, you probably have some other machine you can connect to. Let's say for simplicity, maybe an EC2 machine. You can have full access to, you can kind of connect to, and from there, that will be kind of driving this interaction between the browser and your application.
Okay. So is Sauce providing a service that would do that as well, so I don't have to go get my...
No, because at the beginning, we had to not boil the ocean.
Okay.
Ideally, the perfect platform is when the tests, the app, and the browser infrastructure is all in the cloud.
Right.
And the most awesome vendor in the world will be the company that does all of that.
Right.
However, Heroku, they just focused on getting that application there. They're not doing the testing part. We're focusing on the testing part, but not doing the application component.
Right.
So, for all of you guys listening, you know, hey, great partnership opportunity right there. But then the missing third thing is, again, another kind of buzzword jargon from continuous deployment and agile development is your continuous integration server, where you've got the likely subjects are Hudson, Cruise Control, Bamboo. There's these tools that basically find your tests and run them.
Okay.
And that's it. That has to be on a machine. So probably at a minimum, you've got three machines. You've got your continuous integration server that looks for your tests, maybe gets kicked off based on a check-in or something. Find your tests and run them. And then one and running them means this interaction between telling a browser to hit your web application. So like...
Those three pieces.
Those are the three
pieces. Well, what's a... So now I'm running, and now I'm testing my app with Selenium. What are the things that I'm going to find if I'm, you know, what are the holes or what are the things customers discover in using Selenium that, and what are the actions that they then take to fix them?
Right. So the way I look at it is that the whole why you test, because you can actually be a two kids in a garage startup, and you can go a very long time not ever testing. Because the most important thing when you're a startup is shipping anything at all.
Right.
You have to ship something, even if it's crap. But after a while, once you're in production, you've got revenue, you've got employees, you get embarrassed by you get the testing religion pretty fast. And the thing is, though, like once you have that nervousness of like if I push this out, I will be embarrassed. There's the kind of embarrassment factor, but there's also there's this confidence. Like if I click deploy, what will happen? Will I lose money? Will I get complaints? Will I get paged? You test to the point where you feel confident that you're not going to be woken up at 3 a.m. And Selenium gives you really that good signal or a good bucket of functional tests. This is actually the best and worst thing about it, is that it can tell you that something broke, which is actually useful and also very frustrating, because it won't tell you what broke, because the developer is going to look at, hey, the button is missing. That won't actually tell him to go to line 3 of file B, whatever, and fix this. However, even if you run... Like I say, functional tests, Selenium tests can tell you that something broke. Unit tests can tell you what broke. But when you don't want that confidence factor, there's like something everyone does before they actually get the real testing religion and do everything automated, everything properly, right? There's always something you do. Right before you push production, you kind of bring up your browser and you kind of click madly through the application. There's some kind of minimum thing that you do in about 60 seconds of it. It's something called usually the smoke tests.
Right.
Or just like your sanity check to make sure that, okay, it really is up. I click on the login button and I do get a form back. There's that kind of a thing that, that is an amazing filter. Sometimes you push something out and that breaks. Just and at a minimum level, Selenium kind of gives you running these tests before deploy gives you that confidence that at that minimum level you have the sanity check. And then above and beyond that, you can do all kinds of other coverage for the rest of the application. But really, it lets you sleep at night knowing when you deploy.
Yeah. And then I was watching the video on your homepage that if there is a problem, you can actually pull up a video rendering of what the test was doing so you can see visually what may or may not have been there.
Right.
So how does that work?
So this is where I go into the testing industry is completely doing it all utterly wrong.
Sure, of course. Well, that's why you're here.
Right.
Change it up.
Everyone completely nerds out on these little dots. When you run the tests, you get this, you have 100 tests, you get this terminal window, and it just puts little asterisks on the screen for every test that it ran. And I feel like people are kind of missing the point here. What I look at it is a Selenium test should kind of look like an iPhone. What does Apple do? Every commercial is pretty much just they show the phone, they launch an application, they click around, show you something cool, and then the commercial's over. The next little music soundtrack. The testing profession doesn't really focus on this Hollywood quality, this Hollywood aspect of it. But it's really, really important. Like if you're on a Agile project or someone's funding your project, your customers, but let's say you're doing something for client. They bring you in, you're there for a couple of months, and every week you kind of do a demo, ideal case, of the new stuff that you did.
Right.
Well, why can't you just write a test for that Selenium test that would mimic what someone would do? In addition, record a video of that. And so let's say over a 3-month project, you're making 100 different things. You could have a web page where every week there's a couple more links to a video. But that feature
showing a 3 or 4 step process on the web page to accomplish a task.
Right. So I kind of look at the, where I kind of come from, it is like the iPhone commercial kind of aspect of, to it, but also lots of startups do. Everyone does a sprint. Everyone has a video on the front page now, but it's done at the end of the process manually with really tons of tools by one person. And that's where testing was actually like 5, 10 years ago. Testing as an activity was done manually, at the end of the process with expensive tools by like 1 or 2 people. That's what like QuickTest Pro, that's what they sold, like really tons of tools to one person. And I would love to bring, like screencasting is kind of cool. Instead of showing off one thing, why don't you create a little video of every feature that you have? Almost imagine like a FAQ or a how-to. How do I do this? How do I send an email? How do I, you know, label something?
Right.
Imagine a functional test for each one of those. But you know, mom's not going to want to watch this, look at the source code of that, which would watch the YouTube video.
No, I think it's a great example. I recently converted my mom to Gmail, and she likes to just take her time learning, and a quick search on YouTube, and there's 10 videos, one how to send a Gmail, how to delete a Gmail. You know, it's a consulting company that wants to drive business. But yeah, automating that kind of stuff, you know, nobody wants to go look up and read the documentation or read, you know, they just want that specific, how do I do the specific steps?
It's a little bit of hybrid, because I think you would have like three, you would have the source code, potentially you could read, that would be, you combine that with screenshots, sometimes you just want to skip all the stuff. You don't want to watch a 5-minute video or 30-second.
Right.
You just want to say what it is, but if you have source code that can also generate a video, you kind of can get lots of material out here, which eventually you can kind of put, and I like, again, go back to Apple, like, you can use this almost as marketing material, instead of like deep dungeon text stuff that only for the
developers
and the infrastructure team. You actually can push this out, and it's almost like executable documentation.
Yeah,
that's a big complaint. Documentation's out of date. Wait a second, that screenshot's wrong. So
screenshots are always out of date. They're out of date as soon as you take them.
Right.
You started Sauce Labs, I believe, in almost 2 years ago.
Almost exactly 2 years.
July of 2008. So cloud computing was available then, but it wasn't really where we are today with the event. How have things changed, public cloud? How has that affected your business or helped you in line? Was it in line with what you thought would happen? Are there things that were better or worse?
Well, about 9 months prior, I gave a talk at Google's testing conference, GTEC. It was in New York. And I gave this talk. I was kind of like a speaker canceled. And so I was like, hey, Jason, I was a Googler at the time. And I said, hey, Jason, can you fill in? So I created on Thursday my EC2 account. And then on Friday, I said, wow, everyone, there's this new thing called EC2, and it's awesome. And so I gave this demo of running a test across 2 machines. I had a live desktop, so you can kind of see them running. Kind of almost the primordial ooze of what Sauce Labs is now, was kind of in that talk. And so that was 9 months before founding the company. I'm not sure if people
really... 2007.
Right, I mean, cloud computing now is it means anything and everything. Like, Gmail is cloud computing. That's a load of crap. That was ASP at one time. Now it's software as a service. Now it's cloud computing. But in my mind, cloud computing only means really what EC2 is, like elastic capacity to one or dozens of machines. So it was an enabler for us. But I think before the cloud computing, I think it's lined up perfectly, right?
Like, yeah, sort of.
We weren't trying to ride this cloud computing thing. It just happens to be we're in the cloud computing space. But we were taking the number one problem with Selenium. Like, it takes too long to run all these tests. I'm like, wow, let's get a lot of machines.
Right.
And cloud computing.
And that's because this is a functional test where they would be going sequentially. And so now you're distributed across.
Right. So I try to coin this phrase. I think, parallelability does not actually exist as a word. It's a mouthful.
Yeah.
So I like to, I registered P13Y. Of course, someone pointed out, like, why did you say parallelability when you could have said parallelizability, which is a word? So before this goes out, I need to go register p15y.com.
Okay.
But either way, parallelability is this big thing. Some people call it concurrent programming, or concurrency is the big, other hyped, cool, old cool kids are doing either cloud computing, or they're hanging out doing closure code, and they're, say they're in concurrent programming space.
Right. Cascading.
Erlang, same thing.
Erlang is a hot topic.
Right.
Because ask the Couch.io guys about that.
Right.
Let's get back to Sauce for a second, Sauce Labs. I mean, there are a lot of companies that offer this kind of stuff that's like, hey, we can do this kind of fun. What makes Sauce Labs specifically stand out from your perspective as, you know, being a leader in this?
So it was really important for us to focus on developers. So it's kind of like a polymer, developers. And when we created Sunium, all the commercial tools at the time really sold the QA departments, and it was not really something you could program. And Selenium, it really, with Selenium remote control in particular, got access. So Java programmers, Python, Ruby, Portal, C Sharp, you can program this, and you can have your application code, run your web app, and you can write these tests. And you know, some of the commercial vendors in the space still don't provide programmatic access to this stuff. So the trick is, and this was, you know, what every investor told us, is that developers are a bunch of freeloading cheapskates who don't buy anything ever, whatever. So you are not going to invest in you because, you know, you're not targeting operations or QA. And I think what we're seeing is, again, in the other, even like the new folks in, like the new guard, again, the old guard didn't focus on developers. The new folks in the testing space, all of them, except us, of course, they're targeting the old model, the siloed testing department. The siloed
You're not going to get a continuous integration process if you've got these groups separate,
right?
Different buildings.
And so what I'm seeing, what's already happened, this is old news, with Agile, the Agile methodology where you're doing dev coding and testing all the time, with all between developers and QA, that's obliterated.
But the old thinking was that was exactly the reason why that system functioned, was that there was a Chinese wall,
right?
And it was a whole, you know, throw the code over,
I think,
and don't let them talk to each other.
I think everyone thought they were launching a space shuttle. And I think if you're going to design a space shuttle, yes, you need offense and defense. You need creators and then quality checkers.
Right.
But we're not all creating space shuttles. Like, you can... You know, anyway, so you tear down that wall, as Reagan would say, and you've got the developers and testers, and so now you're in the testing space. You're either now a developer who does testing, or you're doing something else. You're an analyst,
right,
or something. So you're out of a job, kind of. Or you know how to code and you're doing testing. But the next thing, I think cloud computing, perhaps the underrepresented, the subtle story to
untold
cloud computing.
Story.
The untold story of cloud computing is all of those ops guys who are going through this massive panic attack with the testing provider. People doing testing did, you know, 5 years ago. And what happens is developers, they're still cheapskate, freeloader guys, whatever, but they encroached into the testing space. Now with cloud computing, you now can deploy without getting permission from an operations guy. They're now basically encroaching the operations role.
The whole DevOps theme.
The thing that everyone ignores here is that the testing and operations still has budget. Even if it's not Bob in QA, you know, Bill in operations, the CEO notices at 3 a.m. when the site is down or when they're losing money. Like, and you need to make sure the site is up. Operations, you need to make sure that you have a quality process in place testing. So the developers are driving the bus. That's the big bet for Sauce Labs. And so we focus on developers, but yes, they're cheapskates, but they now have access to,
they're driving the deployment decisions.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So we get them at the beginning of the project, and you know, when you're setting out for what you're doing for source control, for everything, developers are making those decisions.
Yeah. Tell us your take on some of the open source business models today, generally, sort of what the Sauce Labs approach has been and your approach to open source.
So I think cloud computing, I think, is the savior of open source business models. Because if you look at Red Hat, when you say, like, you can download it for free, or you can download it for $100, of course, you just take free. So I'm going to run it on my laptop, and there's really no difference other than $100 missing from my wallet. With cloud, there's this phrase, I didn't coin it, but, you know, there's, like, open source. It used to be the arguments, like, free as in speech, free as in beer, really pedantic arguments about what does that mean. And I think that the thing for us is that open source software is free as in puppy. It's a free puppy.
Right.
It's free if you don't value your time whatsoever. So you can go download Selenium, and I went through this. Like, you can go create an EC2 account. It's kind of easy. It's also like, if you've got, you know, a gun to your head and you want to do something, you don't really want to get, you know, roll up in front of the fireplace and read the EC2 tutorial and figure out how to install Selenium, potentially Selenium Grid. Like, the thing I like about open source is that it's the intellectual honesty of it. Like, you don't have to pay us $10,000 before you even kind of see what's there. You can go download all this stuff and do it yourself. And really, our differentiator is we will save you the time to set this up yourself and then keep it running. So, like, we had a moment.
And then you can go play with the puppy.
Right. So we rent puppies. I guess is what it comes down to.
Neat. I want to do a tangential question. Your website says you're based in San Francisco, but that you also have offices in Chicago, Los Angeles, and Argentina.
Yes.
So I classify that as a highly distributed company.
All right.
What's your take on distributed companies, and how do you, as you know, the chief, sort of get that whole distributed company functioning? Any tips and tricks for people who want to do something similar?
So for a while, I had this thing called the Anywhere But San Francisco Hiring Policy. And so when we started with a couple of founders, it's a San Francisco-based company, but I'm the only guy out in Chicago. And, you know, we started the company, and I moved back to Chicago. So it was like, okay, I can start it with you guys. But I'm going to be over there. So I agreed that I'll be here once a month. So I call that the high bandwidth connection. So I am here. Sometimes we have conversations we delay, and so we're just in person, got away with it. However, the Anywhere But San Francisco Hiring Policy is that as long as you have lots of people in lots of different places, it's like a forcing function to make sure that you're always using tools that enable distributed communication. So we use Skype, we use TeamSpeak, we use Campfire, 37 Signals.
Those are your Chicago neighbors.
Right. And, you know, all these tools that if I was just me in Chicago and everyone here, it would be like, oh, great, we have to phone Jason. Oh, wait, how do we use this Skype thing? I don't know.
So it's sort of, you built it into your whole culture.
Right. Which actually works great even for the San Francisco guys. And then they can choose to work from home or from the office that day because, you know, they can Skype in, just so there's no difference between Skyping in from San Francisco versus Chicago.
Right. Neat. Anything that we missed you want to share with the listeners, what we can look forward to coming from Sauce Labs, Selenium, rest of this year, big picture stuff? Or
I kind of subscribe to the, I guess it's Apple and Google kind of does this, like it's the non-Microsoft. We're not going to, you'll find out when it shows up on our blog. It might be tomorrow, it might be next week. It's going to be really, really cool. But always keep coming back to our blog, I guess. And we'll always, every time a new browser comes out, every time a new platform comes out, it's quite an exciting time. And so kind of try to manage that complexity.
Yeah. Oh, I wanted to ask you a question. Now that we're at the end of the questions, I'll jump back in. But all this mobile browser activity too, you know, hear a lot about Opera, mobile getting traction. Is Selenium fit into that as well?
Yeah, so, I mean, Selenium started out with just the problem of the desktop browsers. Obviously, the next big thing is this combination of HTML5 and mobile.
Yeah,
those two things. So there's a framework that's coming out. Sencha, which is kind of renamed XJS guys.
Okay.
That they've just recently announced.
What's the new name?
Sencha, S-E-N-C-H-A.
Okay.
And they also got a recent big investment from Sequoia, kind of part of the rebranding. Charles Jolly, who created Sprout4, he was at Apple. Sprout4 was kind of the framework that created that power mobile meme. He's leading to create something called Strobe. And he's really kind of also, yeah, he did this on the Sprout4 blog. He's geeking out on HTML5 and mobile. And that's the big thing. Also, there's another project called PhoneGap that really kind of targets on taking HTML5, JavaScript, and, you know, making it so you can create iPhone and Android apps by using this stuff. So, like, the really hot stuff right now is mobile. The Selenium project, at least with Selenium 2, we have, it's not final yet. Like, I think the betas are out there. You can download it now. So you could write a Selenium test and make it run on an iPhone. They could drive a mobile browser on iPhone and Android.
Nice.
So we're getting that out this year. But there's lots of stuff going on.
Yes, that is going to be the device testing stuff of the future, though. I mean, I think is all
the writing is on the wall.
All roads lead to that mobile wonderland. Great. Well, really appreciate that overview and a chance to chat with you about Selenium and Sauce Labs. We'll jump into the next section of the show we call Cloud Tips, where we share companies, products, or services that we like. I'll go first. I am on the 30-day experimental period with the iPhone, and so far so good, as long as I don't try to make any telephone calls. But one of the neat little apps that I've been playing with, which works across the desktop and the mobile device and in the browser, is Evernote, just a little productivity app. Seems to work really well. Photos, notes, it does, it'll do character recognition of your photos. And so just a little nice add-on. So that's my pick of the week. How about you?
I got my Nexus One last week, and I am in love with the wireless access points, the hotspot tether thing.
Yeah.
At our meeting yesterday, I had this in the center of the room. We had all our Apple laptops.
How many can be supported on that?
I think it's 4.
And is that built into Android 2.2?
Yes, it's 2.2. And then don't tell anybody, but T-Mobile doesn't realize that they should be charging for it.
Yeah.
Verizon knows this, and so they're going to be charging for it, but I'm on T-Mobile, and so it's nice. My bill is about half the probability on Verizon, so don't yet. Turn off the mic, don't tell anybody, but T-Mobile has my business because they're not Verizon. They don't have Verizon's business sense to charge for something that I'm totally
yeah. Neat. Yeah, I mean, it's getting harder and harder to stay unconnected or disconnected, but that hotspot feature is fun. Neat. If people want to get more info about you, blogs, Twitter feeds, websites.
So on Pugs on Twitter, HUGS, and Sauce Labs, saucelabs.com. We got our blog there. My personal blog, I'm jeremyadolph.com. But Sauce Labs, saucelabs.com/blog. That's pretty good.
Great. And I'm Gary Orenstein. You can find me on Twitter, full name Gary Orenstein. And I want to thank our listeners for joining us. You can visit us at thecloudcomputingshow.com. You can also email any suggestions, comments, or feedback to thecloudcomputingshow@gmail.com. If you haven't subscribed on iTunes, you can do that by searching for The Cloud Computing Show in the iTunes store. Or if you go to our show homepage, thecloudcomputingshow.com, we have a link directly to the iTunes subscription page right there in the top right of the homepage. That's it for this show. Thanks again for joining us, Jason.
Thank you.
Thanks again to the listeners. We'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.